In the middle of January of 1776, the 18th to be exact, Royal Governor James Wright, the man who was running Georgia at the discretion of King George III, was sitting in his Savannah home having dinner with VIPs of the time. Not far from where he lived sat Tondi's Tavern, a public house that for all intents and purposes was a hotbed of activity for the resistance. The rebels would convene here, talk, plan, strategize their moves in colonial Savannah. And they were incensed at Wright. Because you see, a British fleet of ships had arrived off the coast of Savannah, and according to Wright, the British officers were ready to pick a fight. They'd been given the green light to destroy what they could and assume anyone with arms was a rebel. So tensions were high, and the governor had explained to this group of Patriot rebels, and I'm paraphrasing here, "Look, if you let them be and allow them anchor here, I'm inclined to settle things with them in order to," and this is a quote, "prevent their doing any injury to this town." James Wright never settled things down with them because the rebels, a group of young men hell-bent on liberty and independence, instead walked to Wright's home from Tondi's Tavern and stormed into his dining room to place him under house arrest. And the man who made that arrest was in a number of ways at the crossroads of the revolutionary movement in Georgia. 25-year-old Joseph Habersham. And Habersham was the son of James Habersham, an economic titan in Georgia. And for years, one of Governor James Wright's dearest friends. Welcome to the Marked Podcast. Across Georgia, there's more than 2,000 historical markers that tell the story of a person, place, or an event from our state's past. And our digital video series explores a select few of those from Georgia's revolutionary history. And in this podcast, we're expanding on that with additional voices to help bring out the stories of these markers and the context of what they tell us about our state. Before we get too far into Joseph Habersham's story, we need to understand the family that helped shape colonial Georgia. Historian Bob Davis has spent decades researching Georgia's revolutionary era and the people who helped build the state. So, Bob, it seems that Joe Habersham is a guy that had his hands in all kinds of things. Am I wrong? Talk to me a little bit about that.
Oh, you're right, except... He was extremely unusual, and not just him. More importantly, his father, James Habersham, was. It's one thing to say this was an age of Georgia entrepreneurship that built the state of Georgia and is still going on today. All that is good in some that was bad in Georgia's development all go back to James Habersham Sr. It's not enough to say they were participants in building the Empire State of the South. They started it. James Habersham Sr. was the core of it, going back to the 1740s.
All right, so before we get too far into Joe's story, we have to break down the Habersham family. So first of all, they are from England, and then there's James Habersham. He's the father. He is the patriarch.
James is a loyalist. The term, not necessarily kind of at the forefront back then as it is now. He was a member of the king's government. He was a member of the colonial government at a high-ranking level.
James Habersham Sr. was totally pro-monarchy. He was a temporary governor for about 2 years while James Wright was gone. So he was loyal to the crown.
And then there's his three sons, James Jr., our guy Joseph, and then the third brother, John.
His three sons became patriots, were revolutionaries, right? The revolution split families. It split communities, it split families. I guess the most famous family to split was Benjamin Franklin.
It's not an uncommon dynamic in civil wars throughout history. Fathers are typically more conservative, the sons more eager to challenge societal norms.
If you go to the colonial cemetery where the daddy is buried, he's buried and then there's a little marker there. But right beside him is a big shrine where Joseph is and I think some of the other Habershams there.
So James, Father James Habersham, builds a ton of the economic infrastructure in Georgia in this period.
Absolutely.
And so, I mean, by the time Joe Habersham, you know, is kind of through school and ready to sort of start his life, there is a ton of opportunity and privilege there for him.
And there's nobody who's in a better position to take advantage of it, because his father has set all of this up, and his father sent his sons north to college. So they all have an excellent education. They have his extensive knowledge in transatlantic trade and trade with the Caribbean. They couldn't be any better situated to become great businessmen and to further what their father had started. Is that by 1775, when the American Revolution is getting off the ground, there is a whole generation of the older leadership in Georgia that coincidentally all dies. Noble Jones is gone. Edward Bernard is gone. James Habersham Sr. is gone. So you've got a whole generation of men who might have done more to keep their sons in check who just aren't there.
So the picture you're kind of painting here is that, you know, his father dies, James Habersham passes away. This really, this whole generation, as you mentioned, of older, influential men in Royal Georgia, they pass away. And correct me if I'm wrong, but with all of that said, there seemingly is sort of a power vacuum. Would that be an accurate way of putting it? Of leader, or a leadership vacuum, I guess, politically. And Joseph Habersham is sort of right there at the crossroads of opportunity, wealth, politics, family name. Is that sort of an accurate way to describe it?
I've never thought of it that way, but you're hitting the nail right on the head. The people, like I say, the people who might have done more to have held things back or held things in check, they're gone. They're just simply physically not there. And as you say, and as I said before, I hadn't thought of this, but there's a huge vacuum, power vacuum there. And there's a lot of people, not just the sons of the ruling class, but a lot of newcomers, like people like John Dooley, for example, and George Wells and Button Gwinnett. Some of them perennial losers, others just very ambitious men. And in addition to the people you were talking about who are at the top, there's also a class of people who want to be at the top and have never been. And that will lead to the famous factionalism in Georgia during the revolution that divided the patriots and led to people being killed in duels like Button Gwinnett and George Wells and other divisions. But again, something I hadn't really thought of, but again, it's a scramble between two different classes of people to fill the vacuum you're talking about.
As the colonies move closer to revolution, Joseph Habersham is finding himself at the center of a really changing Georgia. And the old guard is fading away, new leaders are emerging, and Habersham is right in the mix.
A lot of these men who are young and wielding influence with property and or money run in the same circles. Button Gwinnett, George Walton, a lot of these names you hear in Georgia's history were part of the same crew in some form or another.
Joe Habersham is one of the most active and energetic Liberty Boys. He is able to secure leadership positions in the militia. He is able to secure political positions of influence, most notably his position on the Council of Safety, which is a very determined, motivated force for patriotism in Georgia, but throughout the colonies. There are councils of safety everywhere, and they operate under the idea of you are with us or you are against us. And they were able to successfully convince many loyalists with leanings to eschew those beliefs and join the rebel cause.
And obviously Joe Habersham fills that vacuum. And I'd love if you can sort of walk us through when he gets to Savannah and starts to really make some moves and make an impact politically. What's the early incarnation of that for him?
He was there from the beginning. he was there from the beginning, even when his other older brother, who actually runs the family fortune, the rest of it, he's talked into staying out of the revolution by his father. But Joseph is in there from the beginning, and his little brother John is there right there with him. And the first best example of this is when the British fleet shows up in Savannah, and Joseph Habersham walks into Governor Wright's house, where Governor Wright is giving a dinner party, puts his hand on the governor's shoulder, and tells him he's under arrest. And then he doesn't leave until the governor understands that he's now a prisoner of war on parole. That was, some people see that as the final moment when the American Revolution in Georgia begins.
And so as James Wright is meeting with his council members at dinner at the government house underneath a portrait of King George II, Wright is discussing this ever-growing mobocracy that's kind of taking over. In past the guards rush Joe Habersham and company. Council members flee out the windows and through the door, and Habersham walks up to James Wright and gently places his arm on James Wright's shoulder and says, "Sir James, you are my prisoner."
Now, something I always taught my students, and this is a very controversial statement, a lot of scholars would disagree with me on this. Revolutions are started by economic conditions, an economy that is being restrained and is being held back. The economy breaks free through ambitious people. A revolution goes out and finds its leaders, It's not the other way around. And so what I'm trying to say is these economic conditions go looking for the Habershams, and they couldn't find anybody better than the Habershams. The economic system was created by James Habersham Sr. It's being promoted by James Habersham Jr., and it is screwing over people like George Washington and Thomas Jefferson and John Hancock and a lot of people in Georgia.
It's easy to think of Joseph Habersham primarily as a revolutionary. But what may be even more impressive is what comes after. And while many of his contemporaries are remembered for a single moment, Habersham seemed to be involved in nearly every aspect of building Georgia's government and institutions.
Joseph Habersham spent 7 years in the military in the thick of the Revolutionary War, and he worked his way up. He started in the Georgia militia, and by the time the war was over, he was colonel in the Continental Army.
It's a job he actually inherits from Lachlan McIntosh, one half of the McIntosh-Gwinnett feud. But politics, that's Habersham's thing. He serves twice as the Speaker of the Georgia General Assembly.
That was the most powerful job in the state government. The governor wasn't. After the American Revolution, the Speaker of the House was the one that truly had the power.
Joe Habersham, Princeton educated, English educated, understands the importance of an educated populace.
Georgia was coming out of the American Revolution, and that revolution did much damage to Georgia's civic organization. It was very important for Georgia to get some kind of foundation on education.
Habersham and a guy by the name of Abraham Baldwin convinced the legislature. They lobby for a college in Georgia, which would be the first college in Georgia history, come to be known as the University of Georgia.
More than most, it struck me that Joe Habersham was involved in everything. I mean, militarily, politically, state government, federal government, the resistance. I mean, he was everywhere, it seemed, all the time, more than most in that time period.
Oh, absolutely. He was, if you would, Alexander Hamilton on a state scale, except that he didn't have Alexander Hamilton's ability of making people so mad at him. Habersham seems to have been there for everybody. That's why Thomas Jefferson appoints him Secretary of the Treasury. He seems to be, he's somebody, first off, in my book on how to be a successful businessman, and no, there is no such book. One of the first rules of it is be honest beyond question. Everybody trusted him, whereas nobody would trust Benjamin Franklin, except that you know Benjamin Franklin had the best interest of the country at heart. Or for that matter, Alexander Hamilton or John Hancock. But the Habershams They understood their business was built on trust. And then if you're going to have trust, you're going to survive, you're going to have compromise and deal making too. It's kind of like somebody once said of General Benjamin Lincoln of the Revolution, the man often disappoints, but he never offends. Well, maybe the same thing with the Habershams. Maybe they didn't contribute anything you could point to and say the country would not have survived without them. But at the same time, you can say, boy, they really made a great contributions. They made great contributions. They were there filling in what needed to be done. Again, I think it all goes back to James Habersham Sr., because basically he's teaching them to do all of these things in Georgia. All of his sons had political careers during and after the American Revolution. Joseph just had the most spectacular.
Following the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia in the summer of 1787, the Constitution is finally ratified in Philadelphia. But that doesn't mean that it's anything official yet. It is sent to the individual 13 states. They hold their own ratifying conventions, and Joe Habersham is a part of that ratifying convention in Georgia.
By just about every measure, this is the date in Georgia's history that matters. Official statehood, the fourth state across the line of independence. And Joe Habersham isn't done.
Joseph Habersham is the mayor of Savannah from 1792 to 1793. So it was a perilous time.
It's perilous because Georgia is still trying to figure things out. It's taking its first wobbly steps as a state.
He seemed to be relatively well-liked. Would that be accurate to say?
Absolutely, and I think he gets that from his father, James Sr. James Sr. was a school teacher. He was a good friend of George Whitfield's. He had radical ideas that could have rubbed some people the wrong way. But at the end of the day, James Sr. was a businessman. He was a deal maker.
And as if he hasn't done enough, Joe finally gets tapped to serve in the federal government. Joseph Habersham is put in charge of the mail.
George Washington saw him as someone incredibly capable and trustworthy. Washington tabs Joe Habersham to be U.S. Postmaster.
And Postmaster General is a really important job, especially during this time period.
Habersham understood the importance of an operating mail system that largely is sending newspapers and pamphlets across the country, which is incredibly important for a young Democratic Republic, for people in places that are further away from the capital in Philadelphia and New York to know what's going on.
That was no trivial position. The only way people could communicate was through writing and through the mails. It made the country function.
By the end of the Revolution, Joseph Habersham has become one of the most influential figures in Georgia. But his impact would eventually stretch far beyond the state's borders. And to help us understand that part of his story, we are joined by Stephen Kochersberger, the official historian of the United States Postal Service. Stephen, thanks for being here.
Andrew, thanks so much for your generous introduction.
So, Stephen, I think that we definitely take for granted how quickly information moves, right? But in the late 1700s, communications could really determine whether a government succeeds or fails. And that's where Joseph Habersham, as a Postmaster General, enters the story. So can you pick up things from there for us?
Sure. Well, if we go back 20 years before Habersham took the reins, we're right at the beginning of the Revolutionary War. And before that, the Postal Service in North America was a operation of the British Crown. And the deputy was Benjamin Franklin for almost 40 years. Well, once the war starts, the British Post is not going to work for the Americans who are rebelling against the Crown. So Benjamin Franklin becomes the first American Postmaster General. And Congress specifically, in their resolution, decreed that there'd be a line of post connecting from Falmouth, which is Portland, Maine, all the way down to Savannah in Georgia. So all of the 13 colonies, states soon after that, would be connected by the state-of-the-art communication system, which was riders on horseback. And a system of post offices.
Can you talk about what we know about Habersham and the desire for that speedy delivery, why it was important in that period?
Well, speed is the essence of communication, right? If a message is delayed, it loses its value, you know, or it can get distorted, or it can be lost. So getting the message delivered quickly is always the objective, whether it's in a letter or if you're doing Zooms, having timely communication is essential. But looking at it from a business perspective, he knew that if the mail was fast and reliable, more people would use it. And, you know, postage was not, it was not inexpensive at the time. It was a considerable investment, generally used for business, but also, you know, casual correspondence. So Habersham wanted to move the mail as quickly as possible. And at the same time, the country was growing. You know, it was moving westward. We had added a few more states since the original 13. And that presented challenges of its own.
One of the other things that really has been is interesting to me about his time is that, and I'd love to spend a few minutes talking about this, is the concept of the hub and spoke model, right? And sort of his role in developing that. And I know that what I have gathered from the research is that he was sort of the godfather of that, but I want you to set it straight. Was he sort of the one that developed that, or was this sort of in the works already and he kind of pushed it along?
Well, before Habersham came on the scene, you know, we have a line of post from Georgia to Maine, and basically it's one post office after another, and, you know, with a few exceptions, but there were the writer would arrive at a post office, the postmaster would unlock the portamento that had all the mail in it, and he would sort through every single piece and take out what was for that office, and then he'd put the rest back in the sack, lock it up, and the writer would take it to the next office. And this would be repeated at every post office along the line, you know, some 60, 70, 80 post offices. So it was not efficient. And Habersham saw that, and he said, you know, what if we separate the mail for specific towns so it's not handled repeatedly and it would get there in better shape and there'd be less chance for the mail being tampered with? And, you know, it seems like a no-brainer, but Habersham saw what nobody else saw.
Well, yeah, and I think about, you know, when I read that, I think about the influence of that model, not just in the Postal Service, but in FedEx, in UPS, in, you know, airline travel, right? I mean, American is in, their hub is in Dallas and Miami. Delta is here in Atlanta. I mean, the concept of hub and spoke goes way beyond just mail delivery. So, I mean, is it safe to say that his influence is here in 2026 all over the place?
I'd say the concept has proven to be a valid one, and it's still in use, as you explained, in many industries. If I want to fly to Atlanta, it may be more efficient for me to go to Charlotte or Nashville first, because that's the way that the network is set up. So we're talking about networks, and Habersham understood that networks are different than just a linear system.
Yeah, and the other thing that comes out of his time as postmaster, you know, to me anyway, is that there is, you know, seems to be an emphasis he places on not just mail and letters and communication, but the dissemination of information to the citizens in America and what's going on in a speedy fashion too, right?
It really was at the heart of why Congress passed the Post Office Act of 1792. And sure, letters were part of it, but newspapers also were given a special consideration because that's how popular opinion was formed. And Habersham, to his credit, he encouraged local newspapers because everybody wanted to subscribe to newspapers from the big cities. And then they would start forming their opinions based on that was the mass media of the time. But he encouraged people to support your local newspapers. And I can see reflections of that and even in today's media market, something that Habersham was dealing with over 200 years ago.
I was reading the bio that your office put together about Habersham. One of the things that was interesting is that he said that the highly partisan papers of the city would spread rage of party. And so, you know, he was stepping up for the smaller papers and smaller communities and understanding their real value.
Yeah, there was a real tension after the revolution. What sort of nation were we going to have? You know, the famous quote from Franklin after the Constitutional Convention, they asked what sort of government did you produce? He said, a republic if you can keep it. So keeping it is the challenge of the electorate and keeping people informed as opposed to just veering towards one extreme or another in their party. Finding that middle has always been the difficult challenge.
He saw it as so important that anyone that impeded such delivery was un-American, if not treasonous, because the mail was so vital to a democratic republic.
Now, the pigeonholes, today we would call them post office boxes. This is a way you can receive your mail quickly, confidentially, right at the post office. And you pay a fee for a mailbox, and, you know, it's very confidential. In the early post office, you would wait in line and you would tell the clerk your name if they didn't already recognize you. And they would go back and look through their alphabetical assortment of letters for anything that had your name on it. And then you would pay the postage on it. Well, some customers, to speed things up, paid to have a separate pigeonhole where their mail would be put in there without anybody else's. And that was the forerunner of the post office box. Habersham didn't like that idea. He thought it was undemocratic. He thought that people who were had more money were getting a better level of service. And he thought that was contrary to the concept of the Postal Service.
Yeah, it sounds like he, and not to say that others didn't, but his perspectives on things were, wildly pro the people and understanding. It seemed that he has a very strong understanding early on of how important this job in this part of the government is.
Yeah, I think you're right. Part of the revolution was doing away with the class system in Britain. You know, we had lords and we had the gentry. And, you know, people who just everybody assumed were better than the common folk. And, you know, it was part of our DNA as rebelling against that is that we should be egalitarian. And I think Habersham really took that to heart. And, you know, he fought in the revolution to preserve that ideal.
I mean, you aren't a guy, you are the guy who knows these things and understands the Postal Service and its history and what, you know, what the role of the postmaster is, Postmaster General. And I don't want to lead the witness here, but I'm curious what, you know, Habersham's sort of, when you look at all the people who have run the Postal Service, where does he land? Like, what is his biggest contribution to what the Postal Service was and is?
Well, I was looking over the list before this interview, and I see he's the only Postmaster General from Georgia that we've ever had of the 76 Postmasters General. He's the one and only Georgian. That's not a distinction in itself. I think you touched on the hub and spoke system. He wanted to improve the public image of the Postal Service. He contracted to have mail wagons painted with a very distinctive livery so that anyone seeing it would know that's the U.S. mail. That is important. And he thought that the mail wagon should take precedence over any other traffic on the roads. And, he was a forward-thinking guy, even in terms of labor practices. You know, in many places, slaves were used to transport the mail because, you know, the contractor could have them work for little or nothing. And There were some folks in the South who objected to that. They didn't think it was a good idea to let slaves carrying their correspondence. But Habersham did not object. He said he found that in his experience that they did better work than most of the white employees of the same station. After he left office, Congress actually passed a law forbidding anybody but a white man from carrying the mail.
Joseph Habersham doesn't have the name recognition of George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, or Benjamin Franklin. But when you start pulling on the threads of Georgia history and early American history, his name seems to appear everywhere. He helped lead Georgia through the Revolution. He helped build the state's political institutions, played a role in founding the University of Georgia, and served as mayor of Savannah. And as Postmaster General, he helped strengthen the communication network that would connect a young and growing nation. And maybe that's the best way to understand Joseph Habersham. Not as the loudest voice in the room or the most famous figure of his generation, but as a trusted leader who kept showing up wherever important work needed to be done. Marked the Podcast is written and hosted by me, Andrew Iden, and produced and edited by the GPB podcast team, Jeremy Powell, Miranda Hawkins, and Mark Davenport. And Sandy Malcolm is the Senior Vice President of Content.